Stepping outside with the now unconscious woman in his arms, Spinok Durav looked round. Figures on all sides, both hooded and bareheaded in the rain, water streaming down. "She is sick," he said to them. "She needs healing." No one spoke in reply. He hesitated, then said, "The Son of Darkness will be informed of your difficulties." They began turning away, melting into the grey sheets. In moments, Spinok found himself alone. He set out for the city. "The Son of Darkness will be informed, but he knows already, doesn't he? He knows, but leaves it all to whom? Me? Theodomin? The Redeemer himself? Give my regards to the priestess. Her, then, this frail thing in my arms. I will attend to her, because within her lies the answer." Gods, the answer to what? Boots uncertain in the slime and mud, he made his careful way back. Night awaited. And, rising up from the depths of his memories, the fragment of some old poem. "The moon does not rain, but it weeps." A fragment, yes, it must be that. Alas, he could not recall the rest, and so he would have to settle with the phrase, although in truth it was anything but settling. "I could ask Endest. Ah, no, he is gone from us for the time being. The High Priestess, perhaps. She knows every Tistandi poem ever written, for the sole purpose of sneering at every one of them. Still." The words haunted him, mocked him with their ambiguity. He preferred things simple and straightforward, solid like heroic sculpture, those marble and alabaster monuments to some great person who, if truth be known, was nowhere near as great as believed or proclaimed, and indeed looked nothing like the white polished face above the godlike body. "Oh, abyss, take me! Enough of this!" In the camp, in the wake of the Tistandi's departure with the High Priestess half dead in his arms, the bald priest, short and bandy-legged and sodden under rain-soaked woolen robes, hobbled up to Gradithan.
"You saw?"
The ex-soldier grunted.
"I was tempted, you know. A sword point right up back of his skull. Shit-spawned Tistandi bastard. What in Hood's name did he think, coming here?"
The priest, a priest of some unknown god somewhere to the south, Bastion perhaps, made tisk-tisking sounds, then said,
"The point is, Erdo..."
"Shut that mouth of yours. That rank ain't for nobody no more, you understand? Never mind the arsehole thinking he's the only one left, so's he can use it like it was his damned name or something. Never mind, 'cause he'll pay for that soon enough."
"Humblest apologies, sir. My point was, she's gone now."
"What of it?"
"She was the Redeemer's eyes, his ears, his everything in the mortal world. And now that Tistandi's gone and taken her away, meaning we can do, as we please."
At that, Gradithan slowly smiled, then said in a low, easy voice,
"What have we been doing up to now, Monkrat?"
"While she was here, the chance remained of awakening the benighted to his holy role. Now we need not worry about either of them."
"I was never worried in the first place," the once Erdemen said in a half-snarl. "Go crawl back into your hole and take whoever with you as you fancy. Like you say, nothing's stopping us now."
After the horrid creature scurried off, Gradithan gestured to one of his lieutenants.
"Follow that Andy pig back into night," he said, "but keep your distance. Then get word to our friends in the city. It's all taken care of at the barrow. That's the message you tell them, right? Go on and get back here before dawn, and you can take your pick of the women. One you want to keep for a while if you care to, or strangle beneath you for all I give a shit. Go!"
He stood in the rain, feeling satisfied. Everything was looking up and up. And by squinting, why, he could almost make out that cursed tower with its disgusting dragon edifice. Aye, soon it would all come down, nice and bloody-like. And though he was not aware of it, not enough to find cause for the sudden shiver that took him, he turned away from that unseeing regard, and so unknowingly broke contact with sleepy, cold, reptilian eyes that could see far indeed, through rain, through smoke, through, if so desired, stone walls. Carved edifice Celana was not. Sleepless, all-seeing protector and sentinel, beloved of the Son of Darkness, and possessed of absolute obsidian-sharp judgment, most assuredly she was all that. And terrible in wrath? Few mortals could even conceive the truth and the capacity of the implacably just. Which was probably just as well.
Mercy in compassion, no dragon lifts.
When skill with a sword was but passing, something else was needed, rage. The curse was that rage broke its vessel, sent fissures through the brittle clay, sought out every weakness in the temper, a mica grit that only revealed itself in the edges of the broken shards. No repairs were possible, no glue creeping out when the fragments were pressed back together to be wiped smooth with a fingertip. Nemanda was thinking about pottery. Web-slung amphorae clanking from the sides of the wagon, a horrid nectar within. A species of rage, perhaps, little different from what had coursed through his veins when he fought. Rage in battle was said to be a gift of the gods. He had heard that belief uttered by that Malazan marine, Deadsmell, down in the hold of the adjunct's flagship, during one of those many nights when the man had made his way down into the dark belly, jug of rum swinging by an ear in one hand. At first Nemanda had resented the company, as much as did his kin, but the Malazan had persisted, like a sapper undermining walls. The rum had trickled down throats, loosened the hinges of tongues, and after a time all those fortifications and bastions had stretched open their doorways and portals. The rum had lit a fire in Nemanda's brain, casting flickering red light on a host of memories gathered ghostly round the unwelcoming hearth. There had been a keep somewhere, a place of childhood secure and protected by the one they called Father. Ridged spines of snow lining the cobbled track leading to the embrasure gate, a wind howling down from grey mountains, a momentary abode where scores of children scurried about wild as rats, with the tall figure of Anamanda Rake wandering the corridors in godlike indifference. What had there been before that? Where were all the mothers? That memory was lost, entirely lost. There had been a priest, an ancient companion of the Son of Darkness, whose task it had been to keep the brood fed, clothed and healthy. He had looked upon them all with eyes filled with dismay, no doubt understanding, long before any of them did, the future that awaited them. Understanding well enough to withhold his warmth. Oh, he had been like an ogre to them all, certainly, but one who, for all his bluster, would never, ever do them harm. Knowing this, they had abused their freedom often. They had, more than once, mocked that poor old man. They had rolled beakers into his path when he walked past, squealing with delight when his feet sent them flying to bounce and shatter, or, better yet, when he lost his balance and thumped down on his backside, wincing in pain. Such a cruel fire, lighting up all these ghastly recollections. Deadsmell, in his sleepy, seemingly careless way, had drawn out their tale. From that keep hidden in the fastness of some remote range of mountains to the sudden, startling arrival of a stranger, the aged, stooped-tissed Andy, who was, it was learned with a shock, Anamanda's very own brother. And the arguments echoing from their father's private chambers as brothers fought over unknown things, decisions past, decisions to come, the precise unfolding of crimes of the soul that led to harsh accusations and cold, cold silences. Days later, peace was struck, somehow, in the dark of night. Their father came to them then to tell them how Andarist was taking them all away. To an island, a place of warmth, of stretches of soft sand and pellucid waters, of trees crowded with fruit. And there, standing in the background during this imparting of a new future, was old Endist Silan, his face ravaged by some extremity of emotion, no more beakers underfoot, no more taunts and elusive imps racing to escape imagined pursuits. He never pursued, never once reached to snatch one of them, never raised a hand, never even raised his voice. He was nothing but a focus for their irreverence, an irreverence they would not dare turn upon their father. He had had his purpose, and he had weathered it, and now he wept as the children were drawn together and a warren was opened, a portal way into an unknown, mysterious new world where anything was possible. Andarist led them through. They would learn new things, the weapons awaiting them. A stern teacher, not one to mock. Oh no, that was quickly made clear when a casual cuff against the side of Skintik's head sent him flying, a cuff to answer some muttered derision, no doubt. The games ended, the world turned suddenly serious. They came to love that old man, loved him far too much, as it turned out, for where Anamanda might well have proved capable of pushing back the horrors of adulthood and its terrible world, Andarist was not. Children made perfect soldiers, perfect killers. They had no sense of mortality. They did not fear death. They took bright pleasure in destruction, even when that destruction involved taking a life. They played with cruelty to watch the results. They understood the simplicity of power found there in the weapon held in the hand. See a bored child with a stick, and see how every beast nearby flees. Understanding well what is now possible and indeed probable. See the child, eyes scanning the ground, swinging the stick down to crush insects, to thrash flowers, to wage a war of mayhem. Replace the stick with a sword. Explain how guilt need not be considered when the ones who must die are the enemy. Unleash them, these children with the avid eyes. Good soldiers. Andarist had made them good soldiers. What child, after all, does not know rage? But the vessel breaks. The vessel breaks. The dying god, Nimanda now believed, was a child. The mad priests poured him full, knowing the vessel leaked and then drank of that puerile seepage. Because he was a child, the dying god's thirst and need were without end, never satiated. As they journeyed along the road, ever westward, they found themselves between planted fields. Here the scarecrows were truly dead, used up, withered, webbed in black scraps of cloth, stiffly rocking in the wind. Poured out, these lives, and Nimanda now saw these fields as bizarre cemeteries, where some local aberration of belief insisted that the dead be staked upright, that they ever stand ready for whatever may come. Watchers of this road and all the fools who travelled it. Once, on Drift of Ali, almost a year before the first attacks, two half-dead Dalhonese had washed up on the rocky coast. They had been paddling to the island of Jenny, for reasons unexplained, in an ancient dugout. Both were naked, as they had used up every scrap of cloth from their garments to stuff into the cracks in the hull, too many cracks, it turned out, and the beleaguered craft eventually sank, forcing the two men to swim. The Lord's nudge brought them to Drift of Ali, and somehow they avoided the murderous reefs and rocks girdling the island. Dwellers in the dark jungles of their homeland, they were from a tribe obsessed with its own ancestors. The dead were not buried. The dead were made part of the mud walls of the village's huts. When one in a family died, a new room would be begun. At first nothing but a single wall projecting outward. And in that wall was the corpse, clay-filled eye sockets, nose, ears, mouth. Clay like a new skin upon face, limbs, torso. Upright in cavorting poses as if frozen in a dance. Two more kin needed to die before the room was complete and ready to be roofed with palm fronds and the like. Some houses were big as castles, sprawled out at ground level in a maze of chambers, hundreds of them dark and airless. In this way, the dead never left. They remained, witnessing all, eternal in judgment. This pressure, said the two refugees, could drive one insane, and often did. The jungle resisted farming. Its soil disliked taming. The huge trees were impervious to fire and could turn the edge of an iron axe. Villages were growing too massive, devouring land, while every cleared area around them was exhausted. Rival tribes suffered the same, and before too long, wars were unleashed. The dead ancestors demanded vengeance for transgressions. Murdered kin, whose bodies had been stolen and so could not be properly taken care of, represented an open wound, a crime that needed answering. Blood back and forth, said the two refugees. Blood back and forth, that is all. And when the enemy began destroying villages, burning them to the ground, no answer to the madness but flight. Nemanda thought about all this as he led his mare by the reins along the dusty road. He had no ancestors to haunt him, no ancestors to demand that he do this and that he behave in this way but not in that way. Perhaps this was freedom, but it left him feeling strangely lost. The two Dalhanese had built a new boat and paddled away, not back home, but to some unknown place, a place devoid of unblinking ghosts staring out from every wall. Rocking sounds came from the wagon, and he turned to see Kalor swinging down on the near side, pausing to adjust his cloak of chain, then walking until he was alongside Nemanda.
"Interesting use of corpses," he said.
"What use would that be?" Skintik asked with a glance back towards them.
"To frighten the crows? Not that any right-minded crow would look twice at those foul plants. They're not even native to this world, after all."
Nemanda saw Skintik's brows rise. "They aren't?" Kalos scratched at his beard, and since it seemed he wasn't in any hurry to reply, Skintik faced forward once more.
"Say Man Kelik," said Nemanda. "The dying god, who will be found in Bastion."
The grey-haired warrior grunted.
"Nothing changes."
"Of course it changes," Skintik retorted without turning round. "It keeps getting worse."
"That is an illusion," Kalor replied. "You Tistandi should know that. Your sense of things getting worse comes from growing older. You see more, and what you see wars with your memories of how things used to be."
"Rubbish. Old farts like you say that because it suits you. You hope it freezes us in our tracks so we end up doing nothing, which means your precious status quo persists just that much longer, enough for you to live out your life in whatever comfort you think you've earned. You won't accept culpability for anything, so you tell us that nothing ever changes."
"Ah, the fire of youth. Perhaps one day, pup, you'll be old, assuming your stupidity doesn't get you killed first, and I'll find you somewhere. You'll be sitting on the stone steps of some abandoned temple, or worse, some dead king's glorious monument, watching the young people rush by, and I'll settle down beside you and ask you, 'What's changed, old man?' And you will squint, chew your gums for a time, then spit onto the cobbles, shaking your head."
"Plan on living forever, Kalor?"
"Yes, I do."
"What if your stupidity gets you killed?"
Kalor's grin was feral. "It hasn't yet."
Skintik glanced back again, eyes bright, and all at once he laughed.
"I am changing my mind about you." "The dying god has stolen Clip's soul," Nemanda said. "We're going to get it back."
"Good luck."
"I suppose we will need it."
"I'm not the kind who helps, Nemanda," Kalor said. "Even kin of Rake." "Maybe," he added, "especially kin of Rake."
"What makes you think—" the man interrupted with a snort.
"I see him in all of you, excepting the empty one you call Clip. You are heading to Coral, or you were, before this detour was forced upon you. Tell me, what do you imagine will happen when you find your glorious patron? Will he reach out one perfect hand to brush your brows, to bless the gift of your existence? Will you thank him for the privilege of being alive?"
"What do you know about it?" Nemanda demanded, feeling the heat rise to flush his face.
"Anamanda Rake is a genius at beginning things. It's finishing them he has trouble with."
"Ah, that stings of truth. Kalor, you have just prodded my own soul. A trait I inherited from him, then? That makes too much sense. So when I speak to him of you, Kalor, he will know your name?"
"Were we acquaintances?" "Yes, we were. Did we delight in each other's company? You will have to ask him that one. Caladan Brood was simpler, easier to manage. Nothing but earth and stone. As for Kaz, well, I'll know more when I finally meet the bastard.
I do not know those names, Nemanda said. Caladan Brood, Kaz?
It's of no real significance. We were allies in a war or three, that is all. And perhaps one day we will be allies once more, who can say? When some vast enemy forces us once again into the same camp, all on the same side.
He seemed to think about that for a moment, then said,
Nothing changes.
Are you then returning to Coral, where waits our father?
No. The dust I kicked up last time will need a few centuries to settle, I expect.
He was about to add something more when his attention was pulled away, and he stepped across Nemanda's path, forcing him to halt, to walk to the road's edge, facing north.
I'd spotted that, Skintik muttered, also stopping.
50 or so paces from the road, just beyond a strip of the alien plants and its row of wrapped effigies, was a ruin. Only one of the walls of the squarish tower-like structure rose above man-height. The stones were enormous, fitted without mortar. Trees of a species Nemanda had never seen before had rooted on top of the walls, snaking long, thick ropes down to the ground. The branches were skeletal, reaching horizontally out to the sides, clutching mere handfuls of dark, leathery leaves. Nemanda had stopped the wagon, and all were now studying the ruin that had so captured Kalor's attention.
"Looks old," Skintik said, catching Nemanda's eye and winking.
"Jagut," Kalor said, and he set out towards it. Nemanda and Skintik followed.
In the field, the furrows of earth were bleached, dead, and so too the ghastly plants. Even the terrible clouds of insects had vanished. Kalor stepped between two corpses, but there was not enough room, so he reached out to either side and pushed the stakes over. Dust spat from the bases as the scarecrows sagged, then, pulling free, fell to the ground. The warrior continued on.
"We can hope," said Skintik under his breath as he and Nemanda followed through the gap.
"For what?" Nemanda asked.
"That he decides he doesn't like this dying god, and makes up his mind to do something about it."
"You believe he is that formidable?"
Skintik shot him a glance. When he said he was allied with Anamanda and those others, it didn't sound as though he meant he was a soldier or minor officer in some army, did it?
Nemanda frowned, then shook his head.
Skintik hissed wordlessly through his teeth, and then said,
"Like equals."
"Yes, like that. But it doesn't matter, Skin. He won't help us."
"I wasn't hoping for that.
More like him deciding to do something for his own reasons, but something that ends up solving our problem."
"I'd wager no coins on that, Skin."
Drawing closer to the ruin, they fell silent. Decrepit as it was, the tower was imposing. The air around it seemed grainy, somehow brittle, ominously cold, despite the sun's fierce heat. The highest of the walls revealed a section of ceiling just below the uppermost set of stones, projecting without any other obvious support to cast a deep shadow upon the ground floor beneath it. The facing wall reached only high enough to encompass a narrow, steeply arched doorway. Just outside this entrance, and to one side, was a belly-shaped pot in which grew a few straggly plants with drooping flowers, so incongruous amid the air of abandonment that Nemanda simply stared down at them, disbelieving. Kalor walked up to the entrance, drew off a scaled gauntlet and wrapped it against the root-tracked frame.
"Will you greet us?" he demanded in a loud voice.
From within, a faint shuffling sound, and then a thin, rasping reply.
"Must I?"
"The ice is long gone, Jagut. The plains beyond are dry and empty. Even the dust of the Tlani Mas has blown away. Would you know something of the world you have ignored for so long?"
"Why, nothing changes."
Kalor turned a pleased smirk upon Nemanda and Skintik and then faced the dark doorway once more.
"Will you invite us in, Jagut? I am the High..."
"I know who you are, O Lord of Futility. King of Ashes, ruler of dead lands, born to glory and cursed to destroy it every time, killer of dreams, despoiler of...
All right, enough of all that. I'm not the one living in ruins.
No, but you ever leave them in your wake, Kalor. Come in, then, you and your two others. I greet you as guests, and so will not crush the life from you and devour your souls with peals of laughter. No, instead I will make some tea.
Nimanda and Skintik followed Kalor into the darkness within. The air of the two-walled chamber was frigid, the stones sheathed in amber-streaked hoarfrost. Where the other two walls should have been rose black glimmering barriers of some unknown substance, and to look upon them too long was to feel vertiginous. Nimanda almost pitched forward, drawn up only by Skintik's sudden grip, and his friend whispered,
"Never mind the ice, cousin."
Ice, yes, it was just that. Astonishingly transparent ice. A figure crouched at a small hearth, long-fingered hands working a blackened kettle onto an iron hook above the coals.
"I ate the last batch of cookies, I'm afraid."
The words drifted out inflectionless from beneath a broad-brimmed black felt hat.
"Most people pass by when they pass by, seeing nothing of interest. None draw close to admire my garden."
"Your garden?" Skintik asked.
"Yes, small, I know, modest.
The pot with the two flowers?"
"Just so, manageable. Anything larger and the weeding would drive me mad, you see."
"Taking up all your time," Kalor commented, looking round.
"Just so."
A long stone altar provided the Jaghut with his bed, on which pale furs were neatly folded. A desk sat nearby, the wood stained black, the chair before it high-backed and padded in deerskin. On a niche set in the highest wall squatted a three-legged silver candlestick, oxidized black. Beeswax candles flickered in guttered pools. Leaning near the altar was an enormous scabbarded greatsword, the cross-hilt as long as a child's arm. Cobwebs coated the weapon.
"You know my name," Kalor said, "but I have not yet heard yours."
"That is true."
Something dangerous edged into Kalor's voice as he said,
"I would know the name of my host."
"Once, long ago, a wolf god came before me. Tell me, Kalor, do you understand the nature of beast gods?" "Of course not. You are only a beast in the unfairly pejorative sense. Unfair to beasts, that is. How is it, then, that the most ancient gods of this world were, one and all, beasts?"
"The question does not interest me, Jaghut."
"What of the answer?"
"You possess one?"
The hands reached out and lifted the kettle from the hook as steam rushed up round the long fingers.
"This must now steep for a time. Am I unusual in my penchant for evading such direct questions? A trait exclusive to Jaghut? Hardly. Knowledge may be free. My voice is not. I am a miser, alas, although I was not always this way."
"Since I see little value in this particular matter," said Kalor, "I would not bargain with you."
"Ah, and what of the others with you? Might not they be interested?"
Clearing his throat, Skintik said,
"Venerable one, we possess nothing of worth to one such as you."
"You are too modest, Tistandi."
"I am?"
"Each creature is born from one not its kind. This is a wonder, a miracle forged in the fires of chaos. For chaos indeed whispers in our blood, no matter its particular hue. If I but scrape your skin so lightly as to leave but a momentary streak, that which I take from you beneath my nail contains every truth of you, your life, even your death, assuming violence does not claim you. A code, if you will, seemingly precise and so very ordered. Yet chaos churns. For all your similarities to your father, neither you nor the one named Nimander, nor any of your brothers and sisters, is identical to Anomanda Dragniporaki. Do you refute this?
Of course not.
For each kind of beast, there is a first such beast, more different from its parents than the rest of its kin, from which a new breed in due course emerges. Is this firstborn then a god?
You spoke of a wolf god, Skintik said. You began to tell us a story.
So I did. But you must be made to understand. It is a question of essences. To see a wolf and know it as pure, one must possess an image in oneself of a pure wolf, a perfect wolf.
Ridiculous, Kalo grunted. See a strange beast and someone tells you it is a wolf, and from this one memory and perhaps a few more to follow, you have fashioned your image of a wolf. In my empires, philosophers spewed such rubbish for centuries, until, of course, I grew tired of them and had them tortured and executed.
A strange muffled noise came from the hunched-over Jagut. Nimanda saw the shoulders shaking and realized the ancient was laughing.
I have killed a few, Jagut, Kalor said.
Not a boast, simply a statement, a warning.
The tea is ready, the Jagut said, pouring dark liquid into four clay cups that Nimanda had not noticed before. You might wonder what I was doing when the wolf god found me. I was fleeing, in disguise. We had gathered to imprison a tyrant until our allies turned upon us and resumed the slaughter. I believe I may be cursed ever to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Tlani Mas, allies, Kalor said. Too bad they never found you.
Kron, the clan of Bekathana Ilk, who dwelt in the cliffs above the angry sea. 43 hunters and a bonecaster. They found me.
Skintik squatted to pick up two of the cups, straightening to hand one to Nimanda. The steam rising from the tea was heady, hinting of mint and cloves and something else. The taste numbed his tongue.
Where is mine? Kalor demanded. If I must listen to this creature, I will drink his tea.
Smiling, Skintik pointed down to where the cups waited on the ground. Another soft laugh from the Jakut.
Raist was the name of the tyrant we defeated. One of my more obnoxiously arrogant offspring. I did not mourn his fall. In any case, unlike Raist, I was never the strutting kind. It is a sign of weakness to shine blinding bright with one's own power. Pathetic diffidence, a need that undermines. I was more secure.
He had Kalor's attention now.
You killed 43 Tlani Mas and a bonecaster.
I killed them all.
The Jakut sipped from his own cup.
I have killed a few Tlani Mas, he said,
the intonation a perfect mimicry of Kalor's own claim a few moments past.
Tell me, then, do you like my abode, my garden?
Solitude has driven you mad, Kalor said.
You would know all about that now, wouldn't you, O Lord of Failures? Partake of the tea, lest I take offense.
Teeth bared, Kalor bent down to retrieve his cup. The Jagut's left hand shot out, closing about Kalor's wrist.
You wounded that wolf god, he said.
Nimanda stared as he saw the old man struggle to twist free of that grip, veins standing out on his temple, jaw muscles bunching beneath the beard. But there was no pulling loose, there was no movement at all from that withered green hand.
When you laid waste to your realm, the Jagut continued, you wounded it terribly.
Release me,
Kalor said in a rasp, and with his other hand he reached back for the grip of his sword. All at once the Jagut's hand fell away. Kalos staggered back and Nimanda saw a white impression of fingers encircling the old warrior's wrist.
This is not how a host behaves. You force me to kill you.
Oh, be quiet, Kalor. This tower was an Azath once. Shall I awaken it for you?
Wondering, Nimanda watched as Kalor backed towards the entrance, eyes wide in that weathered, pallid face, the look of raw recognition dawning.
Kossos, what are you doing here?
Where else should I be? Now remain outside. These two Tistandi must go away for a while.
Heat was spreading fast, out from Nimanda's stomach. He cast a wild look at Skintik, saw his friend sinking slowly to his knees. The empty cup in his hand fell away, rolled briefly on the damp ground. Nimanda stared at the jagged.
What have you done?
Only what was necessary.
With a snarl, Kalor spun round and stalked from the chamber. Over his shoulder, he said,
I will not wait long.
Nimanda's eyes were drawn once more to the walls of ice, black depths, shapes moving within. He staggered, reached out his hands.
Oh, don't step in there.
And then he was falling forward, his hands passing into the wall before him, no resistance at all.
Nimanda, do not...
Blackness. Desra wandered round the wagon, drawing up to a halt beside the ox. She set a hand on its back, felt the beast's heat, the rippling with every twitch shedding the biting flies. She looked down into the animal's eye, saw with a start how delicate its lashes.
You must take the world as it is.
Underist's last words to her before the world took him. It wasn't hard. People either had strength or they didn't. The weak ones left her disgusted, welling with dark contempt. If they chose at all, it was ever the wrong choice. They let the world break them time and again, then wondered, dull-eyed as this ox, why it was so cruel. But it wasn't the world that was the problem, was it? It was stepping into the stampede's path over and over again. It was learning nothing from anything.
Nothing.
There were more weak people than strong ones. The weak were legion. Some just weren't smart enough to cope with anything beyond meeting immediate needs. The field to sow, the harvest to bring on to the threshing floor, the beasts of burden to feed. The child to raise, the coin for the next jug of ale, the next knuckle bag of Debyang. They didn't see beyond the horizon. They didn't even see the next valley over. The world outside was where things came from, things that caused trouble, that jarred the proper order of life. They weren't interested in thinking. Depths were frightening. Long roads, a journey without purpose where one could end up lost, curling up to die in the ditch. She had seen so many of the weak ones. They died unjustly in their thousands, tens of thousands. They died because they worshipped ignorance and believed this blind god could make them safe. Among the strong, only a few were worth paying attention to. Most were bullies. Their threats were physical or they were emotional, but the effect was the same, to make the victim feel weak. And it was the self-appointed task of these bullies to convince as many people as possible that they were inherently weak, and their lives ones of pathetic misery. Once this was done, the bully would then say, "Do as I say, and I will keep you safe. I will be your strength. Unless you anger me. If you anger me, I will terrorize you. I might even kill you." There were plenty of these bastards, pig-eyed and blustery little boys in big bodies, or fish-eyed nasty bitches, although these ones, after proving to their victims how weak they were, would then lap up all the spilled blood, delicate tongues flicking in and out. You had the physical bullies and the emotional bullies, and they both reveled in destroying lives. No, she had no time for them. But there were others whose strength was of a much rarer kind, not easy to find because they revealed nothing. They were quiet. They often believed themselves to be much weaker than they were. But when pushed too hard, they surprised themselves, finding that they would not back away another step, but a wall had risen in their souls, unyielding, a barrier that could not be passed. To find one such as this was the most precious of discoveries. Destra had played the bully more than once, as much from boredom as from anything else. She'd lapped up her share of blood. She might well do the same with this one named Clip, if he ever returned to them, and there was no guarantee of that. Yes, she would use him and people like him who imagined themselves strong but were, in truth, weak, or so she would prove, eventually. Certainly their blood didn't taste any purer, any sweeter. She had made her discovery, after all, of one whose strength was absolute, before whom she herself felt weak, but in a most pleasant, most satisfying way, one to whom she might surrender whatever she chose without fearing he would one day use it against her. Not this one. Not Nimanda Gullet. Destra saw Kalor emerge from the ruin, his agitation plain to see. Armor rustling, he marched between the scarecrows and up onto the road. Reaching the wagon, he pulled himself up with a worn boot on a wooden spoke, then paused to stare down at Clip.
"You should throw this fool away," he said to Arunatha, who sat holding a thin cloth stretched out over the unconscious figure.
She smiled in answer and said nothing. Desra frowned at Kalor.
"Where are the others?"
"Yes," he replied with a sneer. "The others."
"Well?"
He lifted himself over the slats.
"The Jaghut decided to use them, unfortunately for them."
"Use?"
Nenanda swung round from where he sat on the bench.
"What Jaghut?"
he demanded. But Desra was already turning away, rushing down through the ditch and onto the withered field, between the toppled scarecrows.
So who is this dying god?
Skintik, who knew himself well, who knew that his imagination was the deadliest weapon he used against himself, who knew how, in any situation, he might laugh, a plunge into the depths of absurdity, a desperate attempt to save his sanity, now found himself awakening on a dusty platform, no more than 12 paces across, of limestone. It was surrounded by olive trees, a grove of ancient twisted boles and dark leathery leaves, the fruit clustered in abundance. A warm wind slid over his naked form, making the sun's heat, at least to begin with, less oppressive than it should have been. The air smelled of salt. The stumps of columns encircled the platform. They had been painted the deep hue of wine, but that had begun to flake away, exposing raw yellow rock. Who is this dying god? His head aching, Skintik slowly sat up, shielding his eyes from the glare, but the sun's light rebounded from the stone and there was no relief. Groaning, he pushed himself to his feet, stood tottering. Gods, the pain in his head. Pulsing, exploding in blinding flashes behind his eyes. Who is this dying? There were corpses huddled beneath the trees, mostly bones and rotted cloth, tufts of hair, skin-stretched skulls. Once brightly coloured clothes, strange shoes, the glitter of buttons and jewellery, gold on bad teeth. The sun felt evil, as if its heat, its light, was somehow killing him, lancing through his flesh, tearing through his brain. He was growing ever sicker. There was, he suddenly understood, no one left alive on this world. Even the trees were dying. The oceans were burning away, and death was everywhere. It could not be escaped. The sun had become a murderer.
Who is this?
You could dream of the future. You could see it as but a recognizable continuation of what can be seen around you at this moment. See it as progress, a driven force with blinding glory at the very end, or each moment as the pinnacle, at least until the next higher peak resolved itself. A farmer sows to feed the vision of fruition, of abundance, and the comfort that comes with a predictable universe reduced to this upcoming season. Drip libations to remind the gods that order exists. You could dream of, at least, a place for your son, your daughter. Who would wish to deliver a child into a world of mayhem, of inescapable annihilation? And did it matter if death arrived as a force beyond the control of anyone, or as the logical consequence of willful stupidity? No, it did not. When there was no one left to ponder such questions. fury and folly. Someone here had played the ultimate practical joke, seeded a world with life, witnessed its burgeoning, and then nudged the sun to anger, into a deadly storm, a momentary cough of poison light, and the season of life ended. Just so.
Who is?
The god dies when the last believer dies, rising up bloated and white, sinking down into unseen depths, crumbling into dust, expelled in a gust of hot wind. Venomous spears lanced through Skintik's brain, shearing through every last tether that remained. And suddenly he was free, launching skyward. Free, yes, because nothing mattered anymore. The hoarders of wealth, the slayers of children, the rapists of the innocent, all gone. The decriers of injustice, the addicts of victimization, the endlessly offended, gone. Nothing was fair. Nothing. And that is why you are dying, dear God. That is why. How can you do anything else? The sun rages. Meaningless. We all die. Meaningless. Who...
A hard slap and he was jolted awake. A seamed, tusked face hovered over him, vertical pupils set in grey, the whites barely visible. Like a damned goat.
You, the jacket said, are a bad choice for this, answering despair with laughter like that.
Skintik stared up at the creature. He couldn't think of anything to say.
There is a last moment, Gothos continued, when every sentient creature alive realizes that it's over, that not enough was done, that hindsight doesn't survive dying. Not enough was done. You, Tist Andi, understood that. Anomanda Rake did. He realized that to dwell in but one world was madness. To survive, you must spread like vermin. Rake tore his people loose from their complacency. And for this he was cursed.
I saw a world dying.
If that is what you saw, then so it is. Somewhere, some when, on the paths of the Azath, a distant world slides into oblivion, potential snuffed out. What did you feel, Skintik?
I felt free.
The jacket straightened.
As I said, a bad choice.
Where is Nemanda?
Sounds at the doorway. Desra rushed into the chamber. She saw Skintik, saw him slowly sitting up. She saw what must be the jacket, the hood drawn back to reveal that greenish, unhuman visage, the hairless pate so mottled it might have been a mariner's map of islands, a tortured coastline, reefs. He stood tall in his woolen robes. But nowhere could she find Nemanda. The jaggot's eyes fixed on her for a moment, and then he faced one of the walls of ice. She followed that gaze. Staggering into darkness, he was struck countless times. Fists pounded, fingers raked ragged furrows through his skin. Hands closed about his limbs and pulled.
This one is mine! No, mine!
All at once, voices cried out on all sides, and a hand closed about Nemanda's waist, plucked him into the air. The giant figure carrying him ran, feet thumping like thunder, up a steep slope, rocks scurrying down, first a trickle, then a roar of cascading stones with screams in their wake. Choking dust blinded him. A sharp-edged crest crunching underfoot, and then a sudden, even steeper descent, down into a caldera. Grey clouds rising in plumes, sudden coruscating heat foul with gases that stung his eyes, burned in his throat. He was flung onto hot ash. The giant creature loomed over him. Through tears, Nemanda looked up, saw a strangely childlike face peering down. The forehead sloped back behind an undulating brow ridge from which the eyebrows streamed down in thick snarls of pale, almost white hair. Round, smooth cheeks, thick lips, a pug nose, a pale, bulging wattle beneath the rounded chin. Its skin was bright yellow, its eyes emerald green. It spoke in the language of the Tist Andi.
I am like you. I too do not belong here.
The voice was soft, a child's voice. The giant slowly blinked and then smiled, revealing a row of dagger-like fangs. Nemanda struggled to speak.
Where? Who? All those people?
Spirits, trapped like ants in amber. But it is not amber. It is the blood of dragons.
Are you a spirit?
The huge head shook in a negative.
I am an elder, and I am lost.
Elder? Nemanda frowned. You call yourself that. Why?
A shrug like hills in motion.
The spirits have so named me.
How did you come to be here?
I don't know. I am lost, you see.
And before this place?
Somewhere else. I built things of stone, but each house I built then vanished. I know not where. It was most frustrating.
So you have a name?
Elder.
Nothing else?
Sometimes I would carve the stone to make it look like wood or bone. I remember sunsets, different suns, each night different suns. Sometimes two, sometimes three, one fierce, the others like children. I would build another house if I could. I think if I could do that, I would stop being lost.
Nemanda sat up. He was covered in volcanic dust, so fine it shed from him like liquid.
Build your house, then.
Whenever I begin, the spirits attack me. Hundreds, then thousands. Too many.
I stepped through a wall of ice.
The memory was suddenly strong.
Omtos Felak.
Oh, ice is like blood, and blood is like ice. There are many ways in, none out. You do not belong here because you are not yet dead. You are lost, like me. We should be friends, I think.
I can't stay.
I am sorry.
Panic seethed to life in Nemanda. He stood, sinking to his shins in the hot ash.
I can't. Gothos, find me. Gothos!
I remember Gothos.
A terrible frown lowered the elder's brows.
He would appear just before the last stone was set. He would look upon my house and pronounce it adequate. Adequate! Oh, how I hated that word. My sweat, my blood, and he called them adequate. And then he would walk inside and close the door, and I would place the last stone, and the house would vanish. I don't think I like Gothos.
I don't blame you,
Nemanda said, unwilling to voice his suspicion that Gothos' rival and the vanishing of the houses were in fact connected, that indeed the Jaghut came to collect them. This elder builds the houses of the Azath, and he is lost.
Tell me, Nemanda said, do you think there are others like you? Others out there building houses?
I don't know.
Nemanda looked round. The jagged walls of the cone enclosed the space. Enormous chunks of pumice and obsidian lay half buried in the grey dust.
Elder, do the spirits ever assail you here?
In my pit? No, they cannot climb the sides.
Build your house here.
But...
use the rim as your foundation.
But houses have corners.
Make it a tower.
A house within the blood of dragons? But there are no sunsets.
A house within the blood of dragons. What would happen? What would change? Why do the spirits deny him this?
If you are tired of being lost, Nemanda said, build a house. But before you are done, before you set that last stone, walk into it. He paused and looked round, then grunted a laugh.
You won't have any choice. You will be building the thing from the inside out.
But then who will finish it?
Nemanda looked away. He was trapped here, possibly forever. If he did as Gothos did, if he remained inside the house to await its completion, he might find a way out. He might walk those hidden pathways, and in so doing he would doom this creature to eternity here. This child, this mason. And that I cannot do,
I am not like Gothos. I am not that cruel. He heard laughter in his head. Feared, shrieking with laughter. Then she said,
Don't be an idiot. Take the way out. Leave this fool to his building blocks. He's pathetic.
I will set the last stone, Nemanda said. Just make sure it's small enough for me to lift and push into place. And he looked up, and he saw that the giant was smiling. And no, it no longer looked like a child, and in its eyes something shone, and its light flowed down, bathed Nemanda.
I am different, the elder said in a deep, warm voice, when I build.
Get him out,
Desra said.
I cannot.
Why?
The jagut blinked like a lizard. I don't know how. The gate is Omtos Phalak, but the realm beyond is something else, something I want nothing to do with.
But you made this gate, and gates open from both sides.
I doubt he could ever find it, the jagut said, even assuming anyone lets him get close.
Anyone? Who's in there with him?
A few million miserable wretches.
Desra glared at Skintik.
How could you let this happen?
He was weeping and could only shake his head.
Do not blame this one, the jagut said. Do not blame anyone. Accidents happen.
You drugged us!
Skintik suddenly accused him, his voice harsh with grief.
Alas, I did. And I had my reasons for doing so, which seem to have failed. Therefore, I must be more direct. And oh, how I dislike being direct. When next you see Anomanda, tell him this from me. He chose wisely. Each time he chose wisely. Tell him, then, that of all whom I ever met, there is but one who has earned my respect. And he is that one.
A sudden sob from Skintik. Desra felt strangely shaken by the jagut's words.
And, the jagut then added, for you, do not trust Kalar.
Feeling helpless, useless, she stepped closer to the wall of ice, squinted into its dark depths.
Careful, woman. That blood pulls hard on you, Tist.
And yes, she could feel that, but it was nothing to trust, nothing to even pay attention to. It was the lie she had always known, the lie of something better just ahead, of all the questions answered just ahead.
Another step, one more, one more.
Time's dialogue with the living, and time was a deceitful creature, a liar. Time promised everything and delivered nothing. She stared into the darkness and thought she saw movement deep, deep within.
No jagut is to be trusted,
Kalor said, glaring at the lowering sun.
Especially not Gothos.
Aranatha studied the ancient warrior with an unwavering gaze, and though he would not meet her sister's eyes, it was clear to Kedavis that Kalor felt himself under siege. A woman's attention, devastating barrage of inexorable calculation, even a warrior flinched back. But these were momentary distractions, she knew. Something had happened. Desra had rushed into the ruin and not returned. Nenanda stood fidgeting, eyes on the crumbled edifice.
Some gods are born to suffer, Kalor said. You'd be better off heading straight to Coral. Unleash Anomanda Rake against that dying god, if getting this clip back is so important to you. At the very least, you'll have your vengeance.
And is vengeance so important? Kedavis asked.
Often it's all there is, Kalor replied, still squinting westward.
Is that why they're after you?
He turned, studied her.
And who would be after me?
Someone. That much seems obvious. Am I wrong?
Aranatha spoke from the wagon.
You are not, sister. But then he has always been hunted. You can see it in his eyes.
Be glad that you remain marginally useful to me, Kalor said, turning away once more.
Kedavis saw Nenanda glaring at the warrior's back. How much time had passed? Days, perhaps weeks. Nimander stood, watching the mason build his tower, shaping stone with fists, with round hammerstones found somewhere, with leather-wrapped wooden mallets to edge the pumice facing he had decided to add to lighten the walls. To accommodate the giant, the tower needed to be huge, 4 stories or more to the ceiling.
Made with the blood of dragons, the glass of what flowed, the pumice of what foamed with dying breaths. A tower, yes, but also a monument, a grave marker. What will come of this? I know not. You were clever, Nimander, with this idea. Too clever to stay here. You must leave when the tower vanishes. You must be within it. I will stay.
They repeated that argument again and again, and each time Nimander prevailed, not through brilliant reasoning, not through appealing to the elder's selfish desires, because it turned out he didn't have any, but only through his refusal to surrender. He had nothing awaiting him, after all. Nimander could lead the others through. He was finding his own kind of wisdom, his restraint, and with Skintik and Kedibis to guide him, he would do well, until such time as they reached Coral. Nimander had lost too many battles. He could see that in himself. Could feel every scar, still fresh, still wounding. This place would give him time to heal, if such a thing were possible. How long? Why not eternity? A chorus of wails surrounded them, an army of spirits groveling in the ash and dust at the base of the volcanic cone, bemoaning the end of the world, as if this world suited them just fine, when clearly it didn't, when each one dreamed of reclaiming flesh and bone, blood and breath. They sought to assail the slope, but somehow failed again and again. Nimander helped when he could, carrying tools here and there, but mostly he sat in the soft dust, seeing nothing, hearing only the cries from beyond the tower's growing wall, feeling neither thirst nor hunger, slowly emptying of desire, ambition, everything that might once have mattered. Around him the darkness deepened, until the only light came from some preternatural glow from the pumice. The world closing in, until...
One stone remains, this stone, the base of this low window, Nimander, within your reach. I will help you climb outside, then push the stone through, like this. But tell me, please, why can we not both leave here? I am within the tower, so are you. If I set the stone...
Elder, cut in Nimander, you are almost done here. Where is Gothos?
A look of surprise.
I don't know.
He does not dare this realm, I think.
Perhaps that is true.
I don't even know if this will work, if it will create for you a way out.
I understand, Nimander. Remain inside with me. Let me set this stone.
I don't know where this tower will take you, Nimander replied. Back to your realm, wherever that is, perhaps, but not my home. Nothing I know. Besides, you carved this to be pushed into place from outside. The angles...
I can reshape it, Nimander.
I cannot go with you. In finding out where you are, Elder, I become lost. You are the mason, the maker of the houses. It is your task. You do not belong here.
Nor do you.
Don't I? There are Tist Andi spirits out there, and Tist Edur, even Leosan. The ones who fell in the first wars when dragons burst through every gate to slay, to die. Listen to them out there. They have made peace with one another, a miracle, and one I would be happy to share.
You are not a ghost. They will take you. They will fight over you, a beginning of a new war, Nimander. They will tear you to pieces.
No, I will reason with them.
You cannot.
Despair stirred awake in Nimander, as he saw the truth of the elder's words. Even here he was not welcome. Even here he would bring destruction.
Yet when they tear me limb from limb, I will die.
I will become just like them. A short war. Help me through the window, he said, pulling himself up onto the rough ledge.
As you wish. I understand, Nimander.
Yes, perhaps you do.
Nimander?
Yes?
Thank you for this gift of creation.
Next time you meet Gothos, Nimander said as his friend pushed him through the portal, punch him in the face for me, will you?
Yes, another good idea. I will miss you, you and your good ideas.
He fell through onto a thick, powdery slope, hastily reaching up to grip the window's edge to keep from sliding. Behind and below, voices cried out in sudden hunger. He could feel their will churning up to engulf him. A heavy scrape from the window, and out came the final stone, end first, grinding as it was forced through, catching Nimander by surprise. The weight pushed against his fingers, where he held tight, and he swore in pain as the tips were crushed, pinned. Tearing one hand free left nails behind, droplets of blood spattering. He scrabbled for another handhold, then, voicing a scream, he tore loose his other arm. Gods, how was he going to manage this? With two mangled hands, with no firm footing, with a mob surging frantic up the slope behind him. Inexorable, the stone ground its way out. He brought a shoulder beneath it, felt the massive weight settling. His arms began to tremble. Far enough now, yes. And he reached with one hand, began pushing to one side the nearest end of the blood-slick chunk of obsidian. He could see the clever angles now, the planes, and how everything would somehow, seemingly impossibly, slide into perfect position. Push, some more. Not much. Almost in place. Thousands, hundreds of thousands, a storm of voices, screams of desperation, of dismay, of terrible horror. Too much! Please stop! Stop! He was weakening. He would not make it. He could not hold on any longer. With a sob, he released his grip, and in the last moment, tottering, he pushed with both hands, setting the stone, and then he was falling, back, down, swallowed in cascading ash, stones, scouring chunks of rough pumice. Down the slope he tumbled, buried beneath ever more rubble. Hot, suffocating, blind, drowning, and one flailing hand was grasped, hard, by one and then two hands, small, a woman's hands. His shoulder flared in pain as that grip tightened, pulled him round. The collapsing hillside tugged at him, eager to take him. He understood its need. He sympathized, yes, and wanted to relent, to let go, to vanish in the crushing darkness. The hands dragged him free, dragged him by one bloody arm. The storm of voices raged anew, closer now and closing fast. Cold fingertips scrabbled against his boots, nails clawing at his ankles, and oh, he didn't care. Let them take him. Let them. He tumbled down onto damp earth. Gloom, silence but for harsh breaths, a surprised grunt from nearby. Rolling onto his back, coughing through a mouth caked in ash, eyes burning. Desra knelt over him, her head down, her face twisted in pain as she held her arms like two broken wings in her lap. Skintik rushing close to crouch beside him.
I thought she...
How long? Nimander demanded. How could you have waited so long? Clip...
What? It's been but moments, Nimander. Desra, she came in. She saw into the ice, saw you.
Fire burned his fingers, flicked flames up his hands and into his wrists, sizzling fierce along the bones. Fresh blood dripped from dust-caked wounds where nails had been.
Desra, he moaned. Why?
She looked up, fixed him with hard eyes.
We're not finished with you yet, Nimander, she said in a rasp. Oh no, not yet.
You damned fool, Gothos said. I was saving that one for later, and now he's free.
Nimander twisted round.
You cannot just collect people like shiny stones.
Why not? My point is, I needed that one. There is now an Azath in the blood of dragons.
The spilled blood, the blood of dead dragons.
And you think the distinction is important? Oh, me and my endless folly!
With sharp gestures, he raised his hood once more, then turned to settle down on a stool, facing the hearth, his position a perfect match to the moment Nimanda, Skintik, and Kalor had first entered this place.
You idiot, Nimanda! Dragons don't play games! Do you understand me? Dragons play no games! Ah, I despair, or I would if I cared enough. No, instead I will make some ash cakes, which I will not share.
It's time to leave, Skintik said. Yes, that much was obvious.
They're coming now, Kalor said.
Kedavis looked, but could not see any movement in the gloom of the ruin's entrance.
It's too late to travel. We'll have to camp here. Make us a fine meal, Arunatha. Nananda, build a fire. A house of sticks to set aflame. That'll make Gothos wince, I hope. Yes, entice him out here tonight so that I can kill him.
You can't kill him, Arunatha said, straightening in the wagon bed.
Oh, and why not?
I need to talk to him.
Kedavis watched her kin descend from the wagon, adjust her robes, then stride towards the ruin, where Skintik had appeared, helping Nimanda, whose hands were dark with blood. Behind them, Desra.
That bitch sister of yours is uncanny, Kalor said in a growl.
Kedavis saw no need to comment on that.
She speaks with Gothos. Why? What could they possibly say to each other?
Shrugging, Kedavis turned away.
I think I will do the cooking tonight, she said.
Dying, the captain stared across at the giant warrior with the shattered face. Woven carpets beneath each of them, the one on which sat the captain now sodden with blood. Blood that seemed to flow forever, as if his body was but a valve, broken, jammed open, and out it came, trickling down from wounds that would never close. He was, he realized, back where he began. Opulence surrounded him this time, rather than grit and mud and dust on the edge of a dried riverbed, but did that make any real difference? Clearly it didn't. Only the dying could laugh at that truth. There were many things, he now understood, to which only the dying could respond with honest mirth. Like this nemesis warrior sitting cross-legged, hunched and glowering opposite him. A small brazier smouldered between them, perched on three legs. On the coals rested a squat kettle, and the spiced wine within steamed to sweeten the air of the chamber.
You shall have to knock out some of the inner walls, the captain said. Have the slaves make you a new bed, one long enough, and other furniture besides. You are not listening, the giant said. I lose my temper when people do not listen. You are my heir. No, I am not. Slavery is an abomination. Slavery is what people who hate do to others. They hate themselves. They hate in order to make themselves different, better. You told yourself you had the right to own other people. You told yourself they were less than you, and you thought shackles could prove it. I loved my slaves. I took care of them. There is plenty of room for guilt in the heart of hate, the warrior replied. This is my gift. Everyone seeks to give me gifts. I reject them all. You believe yours is wondrous, generous. You are nothing. Your empire is pathetic. I knew village dogs who were greater tyrants than you. Why do you torment me with such words? I am dying. You have killed me. And yet I do not despise you for that. No, I make you my heir. I give you my kingdom. My army will take your commands. Everything is yours now. I don't want it. If you do not take it, one of my officers will. This kingdom cannot exist without the slaves. Your army will become nothing more than one more band of raiders, and so someone will hunt them down and destroy them, and all you sought to build will be forgotten. You torment me! I tell you the truth. Let your officers come to kill me. I will destroy them all, and I will scatter your army, blood to the grass.
The captain stared at this monster and knew he could do nothing. He was sinking back against his heap of pillows, every breath shallower than the last. Swathed in robes and furs, he was nonetheless cold.
You could have lied, he whispered.
The man's last words. Kasa studied the dead face for a moment longer, then he thumped against the panel door to his left. It opened a crack.
Everyone leave this carriage, Kasa commanded. Take whatever you want, but you do not have much time.
Then he settled back once more, scanned the remnants of the lavish feast he had devoured, while the captain had simply watched, smug as a rich father, even as he died. But Kasa was not his son, not his heir, no matter what the fool desired. He was Toblakai, a Teblor, and far to the north waited his people. Was he ready for them? He was. Would they be ready for him? Probably not. A long walk awaited him. There was not a single horse in this paltry kingdom that could accommodate him. He thought back to his youth, to those bright days of hard drama crowded with omens, when every blade of grass was saturated with significance. But it was the young mind that fashioned such things. Not yet bleached by the sun, not yet worn down by the wind. Vistas were to be crossed, foes were to be vanquished with harsh barks of fierce triumph, blood spraying in the air. Once, long ago it seemed now, he had set out to find glory, only to discover that it was nothing like what he had imagined it to be. It was a brutal truth that his companions then had understood so much better than he had, despite his being war leader. Nevertheless, they had let themselves be pulled into his wake, and for this they had died. The power of Karsa's own will had overwhelmed them. What could be learned from that? Followers will follow, even unto their own deaths. There was a flaw to such people, the willingness to override one's own instinct for self-preservation. And this flaw invited exploitation, perhaps even required it. Confusion and uncertainty surrendered to simplicity, so comforting, so deadly. Without followers, this captain would have achieved nothing. The same the world over. Wars would disintegrate into the chaos of raids, skirmishes, massacres of the innocent, the vendetta of blood feuds, and little else. Monuments would never be raised. No temples, no streets and roads, no cities. No ships, no bridges. Every patch of ploughed land would shrink to what a few could manage. Without followers, civilization would never have been born. He would tell his people all this. He would make them not his followers, but his companions, and together they would bring civilization to ruin, whenever and wherever they found it. Because for all the good it created, its sole purpose was to breed followers, enough to heave into motion forces of destruction, spreading a tide of blood at the whim of those few cynical tyrants born to lead. Lead, yes, with lies, with iron words. Duty, honor, patriotism, freedom, that fed the willfully stupid with grand purpose, with reason for misery and delivering misery in kind. He had seen the enemy's face, its twin masks of abject self-sacrifice and cold-eyed command. He had seen leaders feed on the flesh of the bravely fallen. And this is not the Teblor way. It shall not be my way. The sounds of looting from the rooms around him were gone now. Silence on all sides. Kasa reached down and used a hook to lift the kettle from the coals and set it down on the small table amidst the foodstuffs, the silver plates and the polished goblets. Then he kicked the brazier over, scattering coals onto the beautifully woven carpets, into the silks and woolen blankets, the furs. He waited to see flames ignite. When the first ones began, Kasa Orlong rose and hunched over to clear the panel door, made his way out. Darkness in the world beyond the camp's cook fires, a mad profusion of stars overhead. Arrayed in a vast semicircle facing the enormous carriage was the kingdom of the captain. Kasa Orlong stood in front of the throne on the balcony.
The slaves are free,
he said in a loud voice that carried to everyone. "The officers will divide the loot, the horses and all the rest. An equal share for all, slaves and free, soldier and crafter. Cheat anyone and I will kill you." Behind him on the carriage, flames licked out from the countless windows and vents. Black smoke rose in a thickening column. He could feel the heat gusting against his back. "Come the dawn," he said, "everyone will leave. Go home. Those without a home, go find one. And know that the time I give you now is all that you will ever have. For when next you see me, when you are hiding there in your cities, I will come as a destroyer. 5 years or 20, it is what you have, what I give you. Use it well. All of you, live well." And that such a farewell should be received, not as a benediction, but as a threat, marked well how these people understood Carsa Orlong, who came from the north, immune to all weapons, who slew the captain without even touching him, who freed the slaves and scattered the knights of the realm with not a single clash of swords. The god of the broken face came among them, as each would tell others for the years left to them. And, so telling, with eyes wide and licking dry lips, they would reach in haste for the tankard and its nectar of forgetfulness.
"Some you cannot kill. Some are deliverers of death and judgment. Some, in wishing you a full life, promise you death. There is no lie in that promise, but does not death come to us all? And yet, how rare the one to say so. No sweet euphemism, no quaint colloquialism, no metaphor, no analogy. There is but one true poet in the world, and he speaks the truth. Flee, my friends, but there is nowhere to hide, nowhere at all. See your fate there in his broken face. See it well."
Horses drawn to a halt on a low hilltop, grasses whispering unseen on all sides.
"I once led armies," Traveller said. "I was once the will of the Emperor of Malaz."
Samardev tasted bitterness and leaned to one side and spat. The man beside her grunted, as if acknowledging the gesturer's commentary.
"We served death, of course, in all that we did. For all our claims otherwise. Imposing peace, ending stupid feuds and tribal rivalries. Opening roads to merchants without fear of banditry. Coin flowed like blood in veins. Such was the gift of those roads and the peace we enforced. And yet, behind it all, he waited."
"All hail civilization," Samardev said, "like a beacon in the dark wilderness."
With a cold smile, Traveller continued, as if not hearing her, "he waits, where all the roads converge, where every path ends, he waits."
A dozen heartbeats passed, with nothing more said. To the north something burned, lancing bright orange flames into the sky, lighting the bellies of churning clouds of black smoke.
"Like a beacon."
"What burns?"
Traveller wondered. Samardev spat again. She just couldn't get that foul taste out of her mouth.
"Carsa Orlong," she replied. "Carsa Orlong burns, Traveller, because that is what he does."
"I do not understand you."
"It's a pyre," she said, "and he does not grieve. The Skathandi are no more."
"When you speak of Carsa Orlong," Traveller said, "I am frightened."
She nodded at that admission, a response he probably could not even see. The man beside her was an honest one, in many ways as honest as Carsa Orlong. And on the morrow, these two would meet. Samardev well understood Traveller's fear.